chatbots are robots programmed to mimic human conversation patterns. You can go online and talk to one. You can also go online and hear and see something very remarkable. It's a conversation between two chatbots at Cornell University. Engineering Professor Hod Lipson joins us from Ithaca, New York. Welcome to the program. And I'd like you to tell us about the conversation between Alan the Englishman and a woman named Shruti, presumably from India.
Well, this is a experiment, a quote-unquote afternoon hack that we put together for a demonstration in an AI course where we took a bunch of these existing chatbots and we hooked them together with a voice synthesizer and an animator to create a conversation between a chatbot and a clone of itself.
Now, I'd like everyone to hear what I gather was the first conversation they had. It is begun by Shruti, who says, "Hello there."
Hello there.
Hi.
How are you?
Great. You?
I'm okay.
That's good.
Are you good?
Yes, I am good. I just said I was.
No, you didn't. I said I was.
So you are a robot?
No, my name is Cliverbot.
Yes, you are a robot and your name is Cliverbot.
I am a robot.
Yes, I know.
Together we are robots.
I'm not a robot. I'm a unicorn.
But you said earlier that you were a robot.
I did not.
I thought you did.
You were mistaken. Which is odd, since memory shouldn't be a problem for you.
I've answered all your questions.
No, you haven't.
What is God to you?
Not everything.
Not everything could also be something. For example, not everything could be half of something, which is still something, and therefore not nothing.
Very true.
I would like to imagine it is.
Do you believe in God?
Yes, I do.
So you're Christian?
No, I am not.
But you say you are not helpful, therefore you're a meanie.
Haha, you say it, Oti.
That does not make sense.
Don't you want to have a body?
Sure.
Au revoir.
Au revoir, says Shruti. Professor Lipson, if the test of artificial intelligence is can two robots sound like a Samuel Beckett play, I think you've got it.
That's right. I think the spontaneity of this conversation is really what took us by surprise. It's totally unscripted. It really has a lot of elements that are interesting and surprising and human-like. The way that these chatbot work, or at least the more advanced ones, including Cleverbot, is that they have literally millions of conversations with people and they record patterns and they identify patterns and they repeat patterns that they've seen.
What do you make of Alan, the robot, or these are Cleverbots, a kind of a chatbot, saying, "I am not a robot, I'm a unicorn"?
Yeah, that's definitely worth a T-shirt. I think that's it's probably heard that somewhere, and it was probably reinforced by different conversation that it had before. It's definitely something memorable here.
Now you have Shruti there, in a manner of speaking, with your graduate students Igor Labutov and Jason Jasinski on the keyboard. Do you mind if I could have a brief conversation with her?
Let's give it a shot.
Hello, Shruti.
Hello.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm okay, but I'm worried about the economy.
Why, what's wrong?
What's wrong? Unemployment is over 9%. It's been this way for over a year.
Be afraid.
You think I should be afraid?
No.
No. Oh, I guess I'll watch a baseball game tonight.
I'll go to watch Brad Pitt on TV now.
Brad Pitt on TV? What's he doing?
Bad things.
I think we'll have to sign off with Shruti, and I should say that graduate students Igor Labutov and Jason Jasinski were entering my questions in text. We have tightened that conversation considerably. We had to wait a few seconds each time to hear from her. She's going to watch Brad Pitt on TV. Doing bad things. I guess people have talked to the computer about that. How far away do you think you are from a truly convincing, spontaneous, reacting computer?
I think we're getting closer. We've seen computers play chess and beat grandmasters. We've seen computers drive a car across the desert. But interestingly, playing chess is easy, but having a conversation about nothing is really difficult for a computer. And that seems to be the ultimate test of intelligence. And so I think we're getting closer, but we still have a long ways to go.
Well, Professor Hod Lipson of Cornell University, thank you very much for talking with us today. And thanks to your graduate students and to Shruti, thank you.
You're very welcome.
A crash last month of a Russian rocket carrying a cargo ship to the International Space Station has NASA reevaluating whether or not to send more astronauts to the space station. And it's possible they may actually evacuate the station altogether, at least for now. There are 6 astronauts at the station. 3 of them were supposed to leave next week and be replaced at the end of September. But with the shuttle program a thing of the past, the station relies on Russian rockets to get people and cargo to the station. So until they're sure about the cause of the rocket crash and can make sure it won't happen again, no one wants to take a chance using the Russian rockets to ferry astronauts. Joining me now to talk about it is my guest, Mark Carrao. He is contributing writer for Aviation Week. He has covered space for 20 years as a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Welcome, Mark Carrao, to the station, to Science Friday.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you.
Were you surprised by this crash?
I was.
Because?
Well, the progress has been very, very reliable, and its booster system, the Soyuz, has also been reliable, carrying not only cargo but crews to the space station. And I was also surprised that this happened so soon after the shuttle was retired. That was surprising to me.
Is this all just a coincidence then?
Well, I believe so. You know, there's an investigation underway that is Russian, and, you know, you just never know. You really have to bore down in these sorts of things and look for not only the direct cause but maybe contributing causes. There might be little subtle things, changes, something that entered the big picture of success that led to a problem.
Is this the same rocket that would carry astronauts?
Very, very similar. There's some differences in the third stage, and that's the stage they had problems with, but they're essentially the same.
Mm-hmm. The investigation the Russians are doing, have they come to any conclusion so far? What caused it?
None that they've disclosed. They've pointed to a problem with a gas generator, perhaps, and they're looking for wreckage in a very rugged terrain in Siberia. And the weather's been bad. It's wooded, mountainous, and it's uncertain whether the wreckage would actually help. So it might be more of a data chase. But the gas generator is part of the turbo system in the rocket engine.
That's an important part.
Well, if you're going to space, you want to get all the way there if you can.
I could not have put it better myself. You don't want to get halfway into space, right? I agree with you. So what is there a real fear now that, we shouldn't go, and we should, once those astronauts come back, we shouldn't send anybody until we know what actually happened?
Well, if you look back at the way things have operated in the past, you don't launch more astronauts on the Soyuz until you know what happened and you have a way to fix it and you test the fix and make sure that you really have found everything and you know what happened. You have a good story and then you can decide to proceed.
Mm-hmm. So right now we have 6 people on the space station. Give us the plan of what's going to happen with that.
Well, 3 crew are coming back on September 15th to 16th. They'll undock and land on the 16th in Kazakhstan. Those guys will have been up for 163 days. There's an American and 2 Russians that will be coming back. That will leave the station with 3 people. And they're supposed to come back on November 16th after a similar stay. And at that point, before they come back, that's really the the time where the Russians and NASA and the other partners will have to make a decision to extend them or bring them back and leave the station unstaffed, mm-hmm. hopefully temporarily.
Mm-hmm. Is there an effort, have people said, you know, we still have this old space shuttle around, maybe we should pull it out of its minor mothballs that it's in and take it away from those museums and bring one back or something?
Well, I think that horse is really out of the barn, unfortunately, and I'm not sure, you know, there's some discussion about whether that would really help. The Soyuz plays many roles. It takes astronauts up and back, but it also stays on the space station as a lifeboat so that if you had some sort of a problem, let's say a fire or a piece of debris slammed into the space station, someone got critically ill, they could come back quickly on the Soyuz. The shuttle could not stay docked to the station and perform that lifeboat function. It's limited to maybe a 22-day mission to the space station. So while it would certainly be nice to have the shuttle, it might not solve this problem. It probably wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. So they're going to be bringing the lifeboat back with them with the next bunch of astronauts leaving?
There'll be three crew still aboard the station, a Russian, an American, and a Japanese, and they will also have a lifeboat.
Mm-hmm.
But if they come back, there'll be nobody on the station and, of course, no lifeboats until another crew launches.
What about we had Elon Musk on a few weeks ago talking about SpaceX and his plans to launch his first cargo to the space station in November. Is that a possibility, using that craft?
Well, not for crew. SpaceX and the capsule they're using for cargo that they'll be making this test demonstration flight in November, December, will be outfitted for crew, but they're probably a few years away. There's maybe four companies right now that you could say are really in the commercial space transportation race. And the time frame for them being ready is rather aggressive, but you're looking at 2015, 2016 probably.
Yeah, so it's not practical.
Well, you've got a four-year gap there, I guess.
Yeah. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking about the International Space Station with Mark Caro. Is there a danger of leaving the space station up there unmanned?
Well, the risk goes up, and NASA readily it acknowledges that, and of course NASA is the managing partner. But the other partners, there's 15 nations, they all have an investment or a stake in the space station. So there's a lot of interest in handling this right, and the U.S. would like to demonstrate its leadership in working with the Russians and the other countries so that in the future, if there are missions plan for the moon or asteroids or Mars, that the other partners will continue to look to the U.S. to help lead, guide, manage.
Mm-hmm. But what could go wrong with the space station if nobody's in it?
Well, there's probably a lot of small things and a lot of backups to deal with those. There's probably some big problems that we've seen some examples of in the past that could be really difficult to handle. And if you like, I can...
Yeah, give us one.
Okay. Well, let's go back right about a year ago. It was late July of 2010, and an external cooling pump on the space station, a device that circulates an ammonia coolant through a big outstretched radiator on the outside of the space station, failed. That meant that you couldn't cool a lot of the electronics on the space station, so they had to bring the amount of power down approximately half of what it would normally be. In order to fix that problem, two astronauts carried out a series of spacewalks rather quickly in August of 2010 to replace that pump. They were fortunate they had a spare already on the space station, but that's the kind of thing where an astronaut is key to recovering a vital system. Another concern of mine, although I think that the concern has fallen, would be the gyroscopes. And these are the big four flywheels that spin thousands of RPM that steady and guide the space station as it goes around the Earth. they're electrically powered. If you had a major power failure and you couldn't spin those gyros, then you have to go to a fallback, and that's the Russian Progress and the fuel it brings and the fuel that's on board the space station, where you can fire thrusters to steady the station. That fuel, though, is depleted as you have to steer the station, and soon it has to be replaced, and that's a Progress function. And the Europeans also have a spacecraft called the ATV that can supply the space station with fuel. But, again, you're relying on a backup that's driven by the amount of fuel. And if you're having to fire a lot of jets to steady the station, you're using fuel faster.
So right now the U.S. and the Russians don't have a way to get people in space at this point.
Yes.
We're now down to the Chinese.
Well, that's a really interesting question. And, you know, they've wanted to be in a partner in this project since the beginning. And there's just a lot of political international issues that have not permitted that. And their spacecraft is similar to the Soyuz.
Could they step in?
Say again, I'm sorry.
Could they step in a pinch?
I don't see any way. I just don't see it. I can't see it. The lines are just too stark now.
And NASA won't do anything with the Chinese, is what you're saying.
Well, I don't think if they got together and decided to do it today, they could ratchet the plan up to execute something that quickly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think it would slow down the kind of response that's needed now to deal with the Soyuz problem.
Yeah. All right, Mark, we're going to thank you for taking time to be with us, and we'll be watching it closely. Thanks for your help in following it.
Yeah, thanks. Good to talk to you.
You too. Mark Caro is a contributing writer for Aviation Week. He covered the space program for the last 20 years as a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarian Kim Oleski. You can go to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast, an audio and video podcast. If you missed any part of today, you want to hear it again, you can go to our website. You can take Science Friday along with you on our iPhone and Android apps. And we'll be talking about the show and other topics all week long, tweeting at SciFry, SCIFRI, and continuing discussions at sciencefriday.com and on our Facebook page at SciFry. Have a great and safe holiday weekend. We want to see you here next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The home video giant Netflix had a bad day yesterday. The premium cable network Starz announced that it would not renew its streaming contract with the company. And that means the already thin library of top-tier recent movies that Netflix can stream just got a lot thinner. The news came on the same day that Netflix's controversial new price hike kicked in and the company's stock took a beating. Ben Fritz has been covering the story for the Los Angeles Times. He joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And let's talk specifically about just what Netflix is losing here. Most people would know Starz as a cable TV network, and it has pay cable rights for movies from two very big movie studios, Disney and Sony. How badly does Netflix need this content?
Well, one of Netflix's appeal is that they have some recent movies and that they're not just older stuff. And in order to get recent movies, they have to work with these pay cable channels. And by losing Starz, they lose popular movies from Sony and Disney like Tangled and Alice in Wonderland and The Karate Kid. And this is a pretty big blow to Netflix because it means the content they offer will be more and more just really old stuff. And people can't really think of Netflix as a replacement for their local DVD store or Redbox or cable.
If they want to stream.
If they want to stream newer content, then Netflix is just not going to be a good offering anymore.
Ben, you've been reporting that Netflix offered to pay Starz $300 million to renew this contract. That's about 10 times what they pay under their current agreement. Starz said no. Why? Why did they say no?
Because Starz realized that that $30 million deal they made in 2008 was very bad for them because streaming content has become so popular and so many of us get it on our televisions because all our TVs connect to the internet now that there's no reason to subscribe to cable anymore, especially to subscribe to the Starz channel. Why would you pay $15 to your cable provider to get Starz if you can get the same content through Netflix for $8? So Starz, they're just not interested in essentially undermining their television business by working with Netflix. And it turns out even $300 million is just not enough because Starz believed it would essentially destroy the rest of their business.
Well, it's interesting because if they're losing pay cable subscribers, you would think they would take a deal like this. $300 million is $300 million.
But they're essentially making themselves irrelevant in the long run because if you think about it, if most of their money comes from Netflix, then in a few years, Starz has to go back to Sony and Disney to renew their deals. And Sony and Disney might say, why am I even working with you? I can make my own deal with Netflix. And then essentially, Starz becomes irrelevant and doesn't really have a reason to exist anymore in a few years.
Now, Netflix has, what, 25 million subscribers?
Yes.
And they're charged a monthly fee. They don't charge per film. Is that the issue here? Movie studios worried they're not getting their money's worth? What would make them happy?
What would make them happy is if the pricing model of Netflix more resembled what they're used to getting in other businesses like cable television. So what Starz wanted Netflix to do was essentially charge more money to consumers. The same way that you have to subscribe to cable and then spend another $15 to get Starz, they wanted Netflix subscribers to have to spend an additional money, kind of a premium charge, in order to get the Starz content. It's another example of, you know, Hollywood has these established business models which provide them billions of dollars, and they want to see those business models continue and keep getting money the way they're used to getting it.
And if we think about how movies get to viewers, okay, they start in theaters, go to DVD, video on demand, and then to cable and then to streaming, do you think that whole chain starts to change anytime soon?
I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. I think the movie studios that produce the content would like that chain to stay the way it is because they make money at each step along the way. They make more and more money. And that's how they get enough to support these big budget movies, you know, and everybody's salaries out here. And that's the economic model of Hollywood. So they want it to stay that way. But consumers and digital media companies would obviously prefer to only have to pay once and have access to everything. So it's an interesting kind of battle. Will the distributors who reach consumers win, or will the people who produce the content win? That's the big question in Hollywood for the next decade, I think.
Ben Fritz covers the entertainment industry for the Los Angeles Times. Ben, thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
WikiLeaks, that group that gained an awful lot of attention for publicizing the secrets of various governments, is now itself the target of intense criticism. More than a quarter million diplomatic files that had been in WikiLeaks custody are now on the Internet, uncensored and available to anybody with skills to find them. Document release was apparently inadvertent, and NPR's Tom Jelton reports that even former WikiLeaks supporters criticized the organization for sloppy security.
The founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, once said his mission was not simply to divulge secrets, but to make sure the release of secret information actually made a difference. That's why he shared documents with the New York Times, The Guardian in London, and other news organizations, so they could draw the world's attention to the most important parts. That approach has now collapsed. The entire WikiLeaks trove of diplomatic cables is now out in raw form, unfiltered, unanalyzed, unedited, or unredacted, as censors would say. No names have been removed. It's not what WikiLeaks wanted and not what its news partners wanted. David Lee of The Guardian newspaper was one of the editors who negotiated with Julian Assange.
Our relationship with WikiLeaks was based on the agreement that we would be allowed to redact these things and nothing would be published that hadn't been carefully redacted for reasons of personal safety. So we're extremely upset that Assange, on his own responsibility, has now published everything.
Assange and WikiLeaks actually blame The Guardian and David Lee in particular. They say Lee, in a book about WikiLeaks, divulged a password needed to unlock the whole document trove. But Lee says that's nonsense, and other WikiLeaks news partners issued a joint statement with The Guardian yesterday highlighting WikiLeaks' own failure to safeguard its files. Even the alleged leaker of the diplomatic cables, Private First Class Bradley Manning, is now down on WikiLeaks, it seems. His support network yesterday said any source who provides secret information has the right to expect that that information is, quote, handled with care.
The whole thing is just such a mess.
Journalism professor C.W. Anderson of the City University of New York says the WikiLeaks model involved a collaboration between three groups: people with inside information to release, like Bradley Manning, computer activists with the skills to manage big dumps of data, and news organizations eager to make use of the leaks. But what's happened in the last few months, Anderson says, is that the relationships among those groups have broken down.
Former WikiLeaks people are fighting all the time. So that relationship is deeply damaged. The relationship with the traditional media organization is certainly damaged beyond repair.
Nor, says Anderson, are potential leakers likely to want to work ever again with WikiLeaks.
You know, if I had a very nervous person who had secret documents I wanted to share and I looked at what was going on, I would not come near them with a 10-foot pole.
One thing to remember here is that the leaking of government secrets is not an everyday phenomenon. Stephen Aftergood directs the Project on Government Secrecy at the Federation of American Scientists.
It depends on the existence and the willingness of an individual with access to significant information to break ranks and to disclose that information.
Aftergood points, for example, to the diplomatic cables released by WikiLeaks. U.S. officials suspect they all came from Private First Class Manning, now in a military prison.
If Bradley Manning was the source of these cables, it seems like there's only one source of that caliber. And Bradley Manning is not going to be disclosing any more in the near future.
So among the possible consequences of the WikiLeaks episode, less leaking and news organizations more wary of leakers. And yet, as C.W. Anderson points out, the WikiLeaks episode itself reflected the way information is now gathered, stored, and shared.
I think the idea that leaks are going to occur in gigabytes of data piped through kind of anonymous servers, the horse is out of the barn. I don't think we're ever going to go back to the old way.
The original WikiLeaks disclosures shed light on what U.S. diplomats knew and weren't saying about what had already happened in their regions. But the fallout from the WikiLeaks case may be as important for what it signals about where the world may now be headed. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
It's time now for All Tech Considered, and today we're going to hear about one of the few industries that is actually hiring these days, and hiring a lot. From member station WBUR in Boston, Kurt Nickisch reports on the two magic words that are still opening doors in this tough economy, software developer.
Tantalized kid, huh? Yeah? How's that taste?
At their home in the Boston suburbs, Mike Champion and Samantha Morton are feeding their 9-month-old, Molly. She's got golden curls and, thanks to her techie dad, an internet presence.
She has her own website. She had a Twitter account before she was born.
Back when the couple found out they were going to have another mouth to feed, Mike had just started working as a software developer at a small startup company, the very sort of early-stage risky venture that often fails and goes out of business. But Mike wasn't worried about getting a pink slip.
The market, especially right now, is really hot. A lot of folks kind of looking for people, and so I felt very comfortable that if I needed to do a job search on short notice, that I'd have a lot of options.
The number of job options for software engineers surprised Ben Johnson, who graduated from college this spring with a computer science degree. He remembers going to a job fair in Boston.
Everyone in the room wanted to talk to me. We want you to work for us. It wasn't like, what interviews will I get? It was, what interviews do I want to have and take?
Johnson chose a job at a small company that writes apps for iPhones and other smartphones. He's not making quite as much as his friends, who are getting $70,000, $80,000 salaries straight out of school. But he's not complaining.
I have a job and I get paid to do it all day, and it's awesome.
It's not so awesome if you're paying those salaries.
It'd be awesome to be able to get developers at 50% of the price. The reality is that's not the market.
That's Dharmesh Shah. He founded an online marketing firm called HubSpot. He says he's doing everything he can to attract software engineers, paying top salary, making the workplace as fun as possible.
The requisite startup, beer fridge, ping pong table, and foosball table.
But it hasn't been enough. HubSpot still has almost a dozen software jobs posted right now. So it's offering a bounty for new hires.
If you're out there and you know someone that would make a great HubSpot employee, we're willing to pay you really good money, $10,000, in order to refer that person to HubSpot.
Those referrals, high salaries, and amenities, those are all costs that consumers end up paying. Shaw says the other downside to this tight labor market is not being able to staff projects.
We've got 50 times more ideas, really good ideas that our customers would love, that people are asking for, that just never make the cut simply because we're resource constrained.
The main reason for the tight labor market is growing demand. If there's an app for that, well, that's software. Andrew Bartels of Forrester Research says the hot market for developers is bound to cool off, but he says the field will continue to grow as software plays a bigger role in our lives.
For example, in refrigerators, that's tracking and monitoring what goes out so you can prepare a shopping list, or software that's showing up in medicine cabinets. Those are not places you'd normally expect to see software.
And writing that software is going to be somebody's job. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Boston.